Lecture 21, Father and Son.
Welcome back. At the end of our last lecture, we were with Philip, the king of Macedon, following his victory over the Greeks at Chaeronea in 338 BC, and his assumption of the role of hegemon, war leader, commander-in-chief, of all the Greeks for a united campaign against Persia. But now we're going to go back in time, back all the way to the year 356 BC, when the son of Philip is born on a summer day, the son who he names Alexander, an ancestral name in his family, and the son who we know as Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was born, according to tradition, on a very remarkable day. A madman, far away in the Greek city of Ephesus on the coast of Asia Minor, had burned down one of the wonders of the world, the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus. He burned this down so that his name would be remembered forever, and just to frustrate his wish, I will not say it now. At any rate, that concept, that image of a fire in Asia associated with the birth of this young prince in Macedon seemed to cast a glow of prophecy and portent over this young man's birth. He grew up in a household with possibly the two strongest-minded parents anybody has ever had. First of all, Philip, this Herculean, burly figure, a giant of a man, both in achievement and in intellect, cool as a cucumber under fire, but nonetheless able to inspire great passion in these Macedonian troops that he had spent his life training, and a man who had accomplished the seemingly impossible, the unification of the Greeks behind him. He was a man of strong physical appetites, hard drinking, hard living, a man with a huge appetite for food and for sex, lots of lovers, female and male, lots of wives, lots of children. A man who lived life to the full, both the earthy, physical side of life and the intellectual side. What he lacked on the spiritual and mystical side was made up for in his wife, Olympias, who was his third wife and who you will remember he met at a religious festival on the island of Samothrace. She brought into the palace there at Pella, its capital in Macedon, a tradition of snake handling, arcane cults, earth goddesses. She brought this over from her people, who were northern Greeks of the area called Epiros. And in this alien world, Alexander found things that weren't part of the traditional Macedonian way of life, but became part of his own nature. He grew up accustomed to the idea that spirits, demons, and gods were all around you. And when we find in later life that he begins to think perhaps he's one of them, we can trace that idea back to his mother Olympias, a woman in whom he stood in awe, of whom he stood in awe all of his life long. Alexander was subject to a lot of careful thought on the part of his father as to training. He wanted to raise up a prince who would succeed him and create a Macedonian dynasty to rule certainly the Greeks, but possibly Persia as well, because Philip fully intended to carry out that vision, that dream of the Pan-Hellenists like Isocrates, and forge his way into the Persian Empire and make it a Greek domain. So he got the best teachers possible for young Alexander. His physical training was turned over to a kinsman of Olympias, a man with the appropriate historical name of Leonidas, bearing the same name as that famous king of Sparta who died in the pass at Thermopylae, with his 300 Spartans trying to block the way of the Persians into Greece. And Leonidas of Epiros, the kinsman of Olympias, gave Alexander a very tough physical training. So this slight, short, almost delicate-looking youth, very different from his father, with his short-cut blonde hair and that beardless face, he never grew a beard all of his life long. He always looked like the eternal youth, which was a very strange thing in a Macedonian or a Greek. He was subjected to the rigors of learning how to hunt, learning how to wrestle, learning how to hold his weapons, learning how to endure privations of hunger and thirst, all under the guidance of Leonidas. To accompany him in his studies, a little group of companions were assembled. Boys, well, they weren't as young as he was, because Alexander was so precocious, Boyce's own age couldn't have kept up with him. But they were of his generation, and they became a circle of friends with whom he maintained close ties all his life long. The chief of these friends among the companions was a boy, a Macedonian, named Hephaestion, with whom Alexander established a deep, lifelong friendship that had sexual overtones and even later on sort of administrative overtones of turning over to Hephaestion lots of responsibility in Alexander's new realm. He was a loyal friend, and he ensured that these people rose along with him since they had shared these childhood experiences with him. For his formal studies, that son of a former Macedonian court doctor, Aristotle, was chosen. He was at the time examining marine life in a lagoon on the island of Lesbos when he got the call to give up his studies there and come to Macedonia. Aristotle had made a name for himself. He'd been a pupil of Plato in the Academy at Athens, but he had parted company with Plato. Plato's ideas were all on higher things and the intellect and abstracts. Aristotle was very interested in applied knowledge. There were two slogans on the temple at Delphi, where we started our whole story long ago. One of them was, "Know thyself," and I think that would be Plato's vision of what's important about philosophy. And the other one said, "Nothing to excess, nothing too much." And that's the middle range of Aristotle's thinking, that the universe is a great cosmos held in balance among opposing forces, and that a healthy life includes them all. He had come up finally with the idea that there were four elements, water, earth, air, fire, and that all of creation was a compound in various mixtures of these four elements. Well, that certainly didn't apply to his pupil, Alexander, who seems to have been pure fire. And it's hard to think of a master and pupil who got along less well or were less likely to be in harmony than Aristotle, the calm intellectual inquirer into nature, the man who sought these patterns of balance, and this boy who simply wanted to go to the ends of the earth and achieve things nobody had ever achieved before. But Alexander did remain loyal to Aristotle to the extent of taking with him scientists when he eventually invaded Asia and sending specimens back to Aristotle, who, once Alexander was out and in the world, went back to Athens and founded a new philosophical school at the Lyceum. He would get these bundles of things from his former pupil, exotic specimens, descriptions of plants. Aristotle's pupil Theophrastus, who wrote the first book on botany, was able to describe mangrove swamps on the Indian Ocean because Alexander sent word back of these wonders that he was seeing on his journeys. Alexander had three elements in his character that I think set him apart from any other person who's ever lived. He is truly someone we could say is a unique individual. And I'll give them their three Greek words. The first one for me is always enthusiasmos. He had enthusiasms. Enthusiasmos means you have a God inside you. You are inspired by the breath of divine force, and you take up things with joy, with excitement, with a feeling of a spiritual linking to some object of your loves. Well, Alexander had enthusiasms for people. He had enthusiasms for books. He had enthusiasm for this great book by Homer, the Iliad. He slept with a copy of it under his pillow, hoping that some of Homer's heroic ethos, and especially the ethos of the great hero of the Iliad, Achilles, with whom the young Alexander identified himself, would seep up through the pillow and into his own mind and soul. He had enthusiasms for Greek culture. He loved the city of Athens. Athens certainly did not repay the love, but he idolized Athens. He had a romantic streak in him with these enthusiasms that made him at times a very joyful person to be with. Contrasted to that was an Achillean quality, menin. That's the first word of Homer's Iliad. It means wrath or anger. And Achilles was a hero famous for his rages, famous for his heroic sulks, where he would go off and sit in his tent while the Greeks came around and begged him to lead them again, and he refused because his honor had been slighted. Consciously or unconsciously, Alexander followed this part of Achilles' nature also and was famous for his titanic rages, in which he would at times, and sometimes under the influence of strong drink, which was an important social element in Macedon, he would kill friends at banquets in these rages. So his father didn't have that. Philip was always thinking, always rather cool and balancing one thing against another and looking into people and I think being a little amused by the passions that he raised in other people. Alexander always took life personally. And that really set him apart from his father. So we've had the enthusiasmos, we've had the menin, the wrath, and the final thing was something his own contemporaries talked about that they marveled at in him. It's a Greek word, pothos, and it means yearning, longing, always wanting for to see what's beyond the next horizon, always wishing you had what you don't have, always trying to get beyond, driven to seek things that other people have not attained. That pothos, that menin, that enthusiasmos, I think define the character of this remarkable prince. He was lucky in his biographers. Many people wrote about him. And although most of those works are lost, lost in great fires at places like the Library of Alexandria, the city that Alexander founded on the delta of the Nile River that was to become the greatest city in the Greek world, the loss of those books deprives us of the contemporary accounts of Alexander's childhood and later life. But they were read by biographers such as Plutarch in the late 1st century AD, and Plutarch took it upon himself in his Life of Alexander. He was doing parallel lives between the Greeks and the Romans. He compared Alexander to Caesar. He collected stories of Alexander's childhood, much as Parson Weems in early 19th century America collected stories about George Washington, because he thought you got to know a man through what he was like when he was a boy. So he collected among those stories one that I think is very illustrative of Alexander and his relationships with his father and the natural world. These Macedonians were horse lovers, and every year there was a great horse fair held at Pella in Macedon, and horse dealers from all over the Balkans, northern Greece, even some from coming out of Asia with Nicaean horses, a famous breed, would come to Macedon to sell horses to the king and the Macedonian nobles. In a year when Alexander was still in his early teens, a stallion was brought to the horse fair. It was called Bucephalos, or Bucephalus is the more Latinate way to say it, and that means ox head. And it's speculated that there was either a blaze of white on the horse's face, looking like a horned head of an ox, or that that was the brand that was on the hindquarters of the horse. At any rate, this stallion was brought in, and the horse dealer tried to sell it to Philip. But the horse reared up as Philip approached and lashed out at it with his forefeet. And Philip said, this would be a terrible horse in a battle, exposing itself to the spears of the enemy. Philip and his groom tried again and again to calm the horse and mount him, and to no avail. So they were walking off when Alexander said out loud for everybody, "Well, what a shame! That's the best horse in the show." Well, this almost criticism of Philip as a man who couldn't manage a good horse was something that really stung him. He was already at odds with his son. He recognized that his son had a different nature than his own, that his son took more after his mother. They were continually butting heads, but nothing had been as bad as this. And Plutarch works up into a wonderful scene what happens next. Philip then called his son forward, planning to teach young Alexander a lesson, and said, "So, you think you could do better?" And the boy said, "Yes, with this horse I could." And his companions were there watching him. Everyone at the horse fair had gathered around by now to see what was going on. The price on the horse was immense, several talents. A talent is 60 pounds of metal, 60 pounds of silver, or 60 pounds of gold, and it was worth many of these talents. And Philip said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And Alexander said, "Well, I will ride this horse. If I will ride it, you pay for the horse. If I can't ride it, I will pay." And Philip said, "Well, I hope you are serious about this." Now, Alexander had noticed something that everyone else had overlooked. Bucephalos was afraid of his own shadow. They had consistently had him facing away from the sun so that his shadow was cast before him. Every time the horse saw the shadow move, he was spooked, and he would rear up or shy away. Alexander ordered the grooms that had come with the horse dealer away. He felt that they'd become loathed presences to this noble creature. And he immediately came up, seized the reins with great conviction, and turned the horse's head into the sun, and the shadow disappeared. He then got the horse in motion. Plutarch describes very beautifully the movement from a standstill, the first hesitant steps, then getting the horse running, and just before the horse is moving too quickly, Alexander, who's so short compared to this massive stallion, throws himself up and over onto the horse and is now astride. Everyone is terrified that he's going to be thrown or run away with, and they're then amazed to see he's in control. This boy has mastered this animal exactly as he said he would. And he kicks the horse's sides, and they go racing off together and finally return in parade style, the horse almost marching along to Alexander's will. Alexander slides to the ground in front of his father, who is weeping, grabs him, says, my son, and they feel in that moment unified in a way that perhaps they never were before or after in their lives together. But that scene of Alexander winning Bucephalos, finding an animal nature that matched his own, is one of Plutarch's emblematic scenes for the events in the boyhood that really made the man. Alexander remained loyal to Bucephalos. Bucephalos became one of his enthusiasms, and he was taken along on all of Alexander's campaigns. And even when he was too old as a warhorse to go into battle, Alexander would mount him for the parade to the front and then slip onto a younger horse for the actual fighting. Alexander was 18 years old when the Battle of Chaeronea took place. Philip entrusted to him the all-important command of the left wing of the Macedonian army, facing the best Greek hoplites on the right enemy wing, and therefore giving Alexander command of the cavalry. Now, you'll remember last time we talked about how Philip created a new kind of fighting force. He took the idea of the phalanx, but gave his Macedonian warriors, who are now professionals working all year round, these immensely long pikes with very small iron points, very good for stabbing through armor, and with the force of a perhaps 18-foot-long handle or a shaft, spear shaft, behind the blow of that little iron tip, and to have his hoplite, well, they're not hoplites anymore, they're pikemen, to have their ranks leveling those spears forward. Sometimes the ranks are 10 deep, and there's this bristling wall of spear points facing any hoplite or other enemy that come at them. That was the centerpiece of his battle formation. That was the great block that pinned the enemy down. He would have cavalry on the wings. He had another group who were called shield bearers who were also involved. But the critical thing was that the cavalry would split off on the wing, attack the enemy on the flank, drive them against this great prickly wall of spear points, and like a hammer driving down on an anvil would crush the enemy between the cavalry, who you'll remember had not been used much in Greek warfare for centuries, certainly not used in a sensible way, and that immovable front line of the sarissas, those super long pikes. Alexander's job then was to part from the center, swing around, and attack the Greeks on their right side. And you will also remember from our talking about the hoplite phalanx and hoplite tactics that with their shields on their left arms, everybody in the hoplite phalanx was protecting the man to his left, but the man at the far right of the formation had nothing and nobody protecting him. And you'll remember back to the Battle of Cunaxa with Xenophon and the 10,000 on the plains near the Euphrates River, under Cyrus the Prince of Persia, that the Greeks refused to move away from the river because it would have left those right-handed men, those men at the far right-hand end of the phalanx, without protection. Alexander swung his cavalry around at Chaeronea, suddenly was facing the rows of Greek hoplites on their exposed side, and was able in his charge then to push them and make them retreat and create chaos in the Greek ranks, and the result was an overwhelming victory for Philip. At the party that night, the victory party, Philip, hard drinking as usual, got drunk, and he led a sort of chain dance through the camp in front of the pens where the Greek prisoners were kept, and was reveling and singing. He'd wreathed ivy around his head. He was playing the part of Bacchus or a Silenus or a Satyr, and one of the Greeks shouted out to him, "King, nature cut you out for Agamemnon. Why do you play the part of Thersites?" And Thersites is a figure of very low caste and low aspirations in the Iliad, a man who opposed Agamemnon and was very anti-heroic. And immediately at this insult, Philip sobered up and had that man who had called out to him brought out and dressed and fed and treated well, and got out of that mood of semi-barbaric revelry. Philip and Alexander went then to the Isthmus, and that is where, you will remember, Philip had himself proclaimed hegemon, commander-in-chief of the Greeks, for a campaign against Asia. The only Greeks who held out were the Spartans, and that holding out is going to cast a bit of a shadow into the future for Alexander, the fact that the Spartans would never join in this surrender of their foreign policies to Philip, the recognition of Macedon as their leader. That had been Sparta's traditional role. Think back to the great year 480 BC of Xerxes' invasion. Sparta fought very hard both to keep the Persians out and to hold on to their own position as the leaders of the Greeks. And they weren't about to turn that over to the Macedonians. And given the mountain fastnesses in which the Spartans live, it just didn't seem worth it to Philip to go down and wage a campaign against them. So he returned to Macedon with Alexander and, in the ebullience of his nature, took another wife, a young girl named Cleopatra. And she was of good Macedonian stock. Remember, Alexander himself is a bit of a half-breed. His mother is an Epirot Greek, and his father is a Macedonian. At the wedding feast, when everybody's getting drunk, the bride's father drinks a toast to the upcoming nuptials and hopes that the union of Philip and young Cleopatra will result in a true-born Macedonian heir to the throne. Alexander is sitting right there listening to this deadly insult. He has inherited from his mother a paranoia about whether or not he will actually succeed his father. Macedonian royal families, in fact, as with many Indo-European tribes, have a royal line, but the warriors elect out of the royal line who shall succeed the dead king. And Alexander is not guaranteed, even as firstborn son, that the succession will be his. So he stands up and throws his drinking cup at this father of the bride, hits him. Philip, then in a rage, gets up, pulls out his sword, is ready to fight with his own son and perhaps kill him. But fortunately, there's a low table in the way, and Philip stumbles over it, falls on his face. Alexander looks at him in complete contempt and leaves not only the hall of feasting, but Macedon itself, and goes west into the Balkans to campaign there, get as far away as he can from his father. Ultimately, he's called back because Philip is now ready to campaign in Asia to launch that war. He's already sent two generals, Parmenio and Attalus, with a Macedonian army across the Hellespont into Asia Minor, modern Turkey, to soften up the resistance and prepare the way for the main invasion force. But there's a ceremony to go through before he goes, and he wants Alexander by his side. He wants to show everyone he's mended his fences with his son. Alexander, at the age of 20, will be left behind, the years 336 BC, as regent in Philip's place while Philip is gone conquering Persia. And so they enter the great theater at Ege together. This may have been the place where the great Athenian playwright Euripides first presented his masterpiece, The Bacchae, in which a king is torn apart by maenads, by women made into a frenzied state by exposure to the god Dionysus, kind of an ill-omened play for kings. At any rate, Philip enters the theater. It's part of another royal wedding, not his own this time. Alexander is by his side. Philip is not wearing armor, just a white robe. He wants to show everyone, all these foreign guests who have come for this grand celebration, that he rules by love, not by fear. And ironically, one of his own bodyguards, a man named Pausanias, with whom Philip had once had a torrid romantic relationship and then cast aside, has nursed a grievance for years and takes advantage of the king's exposure to run forward, stab him, and kill him. Philip is dead instantly, falls in the dust of the theater. Pausanias is surrounded. There was a horse nearby waiting to carry him to safety. He trips on a root, falls down. The Macedonians are on him and kill him at once. So nobody ever found out who was behind this. Lots of people took credit and lots of people were suspected. The Athenians were believed to maybe have had a hand in it. Alexander and his mother Olympias were thought perhaps to be the instigators of Philip's death. And the great king of Persia, way off in Susa, took credit and said, I'm the one who guided the hand that killed Philip for having the temerity to say that he would invade my kingdom. At any rate, Alexander immediately stepped forward, seized the reins of Macedon, eliminated possible contenders for the throne, and made himself the new great king, inheriting not only the realm, but his father's mission to conquer Asia. It took him 2 years to solidify his position at home and to go back down into Greece and get those rebellious Greeks behind him, because as soon as Philip was dead, they all thought, well, the strong man is gone. We are free now to follow our own devices. Alexander soon disabused them of that notion. He summoned them back to the Isthmus, and he got them behind him as commander-in-chief the way they had been behind his father. He also took advantage, Alexander, of being in Greece to go visit the shrine of the Delphic Oracle. We started our story in Delphi, there on the slopes of Mount Parnassus, way back in the 540s BC, more than 200 years ago, as far as Alexander is concerned, when Croesus of Lydia, the king who feared the approach of the Persians, sent envoys to Delphi to ask the oracle's advice. Alexander was now going the other way. He was going into Asia from Greece, and he wanted the oracle's advice and the god's blessing. So he went to the temple. He arrived in early winter, the month we would call November, and the oracle was closed. She shut down for the winter, and she didn't like to prophesy on wrong days. Apollo himself went away in the winter, and his rather dark and impulsive half-brother Dionysus took over. So it wasn't a time you could normally consult the oracle. Well, Alexander had one of his rages and grabbed the woman and was actually pushing her down the ramp into the crypt where she would prophesy when she turned to him and said, boy, there is no resisting you. And he took his hands off her at once and said, that's oracle enough for me. It was exactly the words that he'd wanted to hear, and he left her there and went home, assembled his troops, and moved towards the Hellespont. Now, you remember there's still a Macedonian army on the other side, so the Persians are not able to get up to the Asiatic coast and block his passage. He calls for the fleets of the Greeks who are allied to him. The Athenians send 20 ships, others send more. He's got a fleet of over 100 triremes. He's got many merchant vessels. And along that strip of water between Sestos on the European side and Abydos on the Asiatic side, the same place where Xerxes had suspended his two pontoon bridges in 480 BC, the great ferrying of the army begins. Meanwhile, Alexander has a special role in mind for himself. He takes one trireme. He goes down to the coast opposite Troy, and he steers that trireme across himself. And a little like MacArthur there in the South Pacific, wanting to have that moment that will encapsulate the arrival of the conqueror. As his trireme's ram was approaching the soil of Asia, he ran forward to the prow, grabbed his spear, and threw it over into the sands of the beach so that he could then claim that all of Asia was spear-won land by him, the irresistible conqueror. He then joined his friend Hephaestion. They went to Troy, performed ceremonies at the tomb of Achilles, made offerings at the site of Troy, and there in the temple were shown by the local inhabitants a suit of armor that was said to go back to the Trojan War. Alexander stripped off his own armor, took that instead, and carried it on his campaigns as a talisman, a good luck token, and something that linked him not just to that avowed claim, that PR claim that he and his father were going to avenge the burning of the Greek temples by Xerxes, but tied into something that Herodotus had put into people's minds, the world is divided between East and West, the Trojan War was just one episode in that great conflict, and any Greek who involves himself in the war with Persia is partaking of this great struggle, the greatest of struggles in history. Next time, we will follow Alexander down the coast as he sets about carrying out his promise to liberate the Greeks of Asia.